Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Stephen Pine's recent article in Scientific American is titled, "We Are Living in the Pyrocene at Our Peril." He says today we live in a fire age in which ancient prophecies of worlds destroyed and renewed by fire have become contemporary realities, even for people living in modern cities. In the summer of 2023, millions of residents in New York City and other metropolises saw dark orange daytime skies thick with smoke palls from Canadian wildfires and breathed in the effluent. Mythology has morphed into ecology. Stephen Pine is a fire historian, urban farmer, and emeritus professor at Arizona State University. We'll revisit our conversation from June with him following the news.
This episode of Access Utah was originally broadcast in June.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Stephen Pine's recent article in Scientific American is titled, "We Are Living in the Pyrocene at Our Peril." He says today we live in a fire age in which ancient prophecies of worlds destroyed and renewed by fire have become contemporary realities, even for people living in modern cities. In the summer of 2023, millions of residents of New York City and other metropolises saw dark orange daytime skies thick with smoke pails from Canadian wildfires and breathed in the effluent. Mythology has morphed into ecology. Stephen Pine is a fire historian, urban farmer, and emeritus professor at Arizona State University. He spent 15 seasons with the North Rim Longshots, a fire crew at the Grand Canyon National Park. Out of those seasons emerged a scholarly interest in the history and management of fire. He's written more than 30 books. His two most recent books are Five Suns, A Fire History of Mexico, and Pyrocene Park. From 2024 and 2023, respectively. Stephen Pine, thanks for joining us on Access Utah.
Well, thank you, and good morning.
Good morning. So you're speaking to me from the Phoenix area, I believe.
Yep.
I think it occurs to me this summer, this fire season has been relatively quiet, I believe.
Yeah. Yes, it has, generally. The Southwest begins in the Southeast in the spring and then in the Southwest. And then by July, August, it tends to move into the Northern Rockies and perhaps Alaska. So we have a lot yet to come. I think the big uncertainty is California. It's been in a wet cycle, which is great for calming its forest fires and filling its reservoirs. But that also means that you're growing lots and lots of grass and shrubs, and those will be very amenable to burning. We're starting to see a few, but we'll have to see how the summer evolves. So there's plenty there to burn, so yeah. That could come back. So fire, what underpins fire is a cycle of wetting and drying. It has to be wet enough to grow stuff, and then it has to be dry enough to allow that to burn. So where you have those cycles within a year, over years, you tend to have characteristic fires, and that's what we're looking at now.
So you say when you were 18, a few days after graduating high school, I'm reading from your article here, you found yourself on a forest crew at the Grand Canyon National Park. You returned for 15 seasons and became a pyromaniac, you say. So I guess you enjoyed this life. Tell me a bit about what it's like to be a hotshot firefighter.
Well, first of all, I wasn't a pyromaniac, and am not now. I'm a pyromantic.
Oh, I misread that. Sorry, pyromantic. Yes,
that's fine. It's an important distinction.
Yes,
we need to be careful about that. Well, I had grown up in Phoenix, basic suburb, and suddenly found myself on a forest fire crew somewhat by accident, and had no idea where I was or what I was doing, and it was kind of a real shock. I loved it. It was a extraordinary place. It was a very compelling job. It was a lot of fun. You're working at hard stuff with a gang of other like-minded folks. And because I was going to college, then later went on to grad school, I could continue to come back during the summers. And I saw no reason to quit. Usually it's a seasonal job. Fire season's a time in your life. You do it for a season, two, maybe three seasons, and then you go on. And I just didn't quit and kept at it. And then eventually in 76, I got my doctorate and thought that really, I really had become quite fascinated by fire and didn't see anybody writing about it in the way that I, as an academic historian, had been trained to think about things. So I decided that would be my project. And it took several years. And eventually I wrote a book, Fire in America, sort of a lame title, but it was a large book. And that set me on my path. And continued to write about other countries and the world. And that led to a sense that humanity and fire is a central story for both the earth and for us. And I think we have become so large that mutual assistance pact or tag team, whatever metaphor you'd care to apply, is remaking the planet. We have created the fire equivalent of an ice age. And this is, it's not just, it didn't just begin with burning fossil fuels that gave it afterburners. It began really at the end of the last ice age when a fire wielding creature, the only one on the planet, species monopolist with regard to fire, encountered a more fire receptive Earth and began interacting. And now that has become a defining feature for the planet. And we're living with its consequences.
You point out that Earth is a fire planet, the only one we know of, I guess, because of oxygen, right? That in many ways, fire resembles a virus. How so?
Well, the Earth is the only fire planet we know because it's the only planet with life as we know it. And fire is very much a creation of the living world. I mean, life created the oxygen. But life also created and organizes the fuels. So as soon as plants began colonizing continents 420 plus million years ago, they began to burn. And they've been burning ever since. So that is really an integral feature. Even the chemistry of fire is a biochemistry. When it occurs in our cells, we call it respiration. When the same reaction occurs in the wide world, we call it fire. So it's been around for a long time. And humans, to put it very succinctly, we got small guts and big heads because we learned to cook food. And then we went to the top of the food chain because we learned to cook landscapes. And now we've become a geologic force because we're cooking the planet. So we are very much a fire creature. And we're creating a world that is more and more amenable to fire, and in ways that we didn't anticipate, and probably would like to see reformed.
You talk
So I
about
didn't get the
the
second part of your question. I
oh
lost
oh
it in my.
oh oh sorry sorry the
No, that's.
that that fire is like a virus.
Oh yeah, well it spreads by contagion. And in many ways, and it's also an interesting question whether fire is alive. And my stand has been no, it's not alive, but it is a creation of the living world and takes on properties accordingly, much like the living world. But that also, and in some ways, it reminds me of a virus. But then we get into definitions: is a virus alive or not? And that depends who you ask. And so the question whether fire is alive can't be solved by saying, well, it's like a virus, because that still leaves unresolved whether a virus is living or not. But it certainly has lots of properties. I mean, it breathes, it feeds, it moves. In many ways, the domestication of fire is a lot like tending children. You have to feed it, clean up after it. You have to train it. It's a relationship. It's not just a tool. And it requires us to behave in certain ways for it to do what we want. So.
You in the article, you talk about three fires, first fire, second fire, third fire. I wonder if you take us through that, kind of looking at the scope of history, humans and fire, yeah. Right? So you say first fire is nature's fire. I guess lightning strikes, and there you have it.
Right. And that's, you know, that's been around as long as plants have been on land. And so we have fossil charcoal 420 plus million years old. But it can be very patchy. Not every place burns every year. But nonetheless, fire has been a part of living landscapes as long as those terrestrial landscapes have been around. Second fire is my term for the human domestication of fire, or the taming of it in some ways. Capturing fire, we didn't invent fire, it was already out there. Capturing it, using it for different purposes, and so forth. But whether for hunting, whether to promote berries, even used in fishing at night, I mean, there's just endless uses for fire. But they all occurred within this context of living landscapes. And so there are kind of ecological checks and balances. Fire had grown up with these systems. When people began changing it, there are still limits to what they can do. They can't do whatever they want. So if you want more fire, which in many ways means more power, then you have to find more stuff to burn. And this leads to third fire, which is the burning of fossil fuels, or what I think of as lithic landscapes in contrast to living landscapes. Once living, now they're buried deep in geologic time. We're taking them out and now burning them again, and then effectively releasing their effluent into the geologic future. And what changes here are several things. One is that you're not burning fire directly on the landscape in the same way. Okay, there may be an occasional oil spill or equivalent, but that's, we're burning them in special chambers. And so the effect of the fire is indirect. It's empowering us to make changes in how we live on the land and so forth. It also occurs outside of the old ecological checks and balances. I mean, fire had seasons. It had times in a day when it burned more vigorously than other times. But now you can burn day and night, winter, summer, wet or dry, it doesn't matter. So the old, in a sense, it's like a factory farm. You can now maximize the production of power out of combustion. We've deconstructed fire into just basic combustion now, but we don't have any place for all of its byproducts to go. And so it's not a question now of finding more stuff to burn. We've got lots and lots of stuff to burn, fossil fuels. The problem is what to do with all the effluent. And now it's overloading the atmosphere. It's overloading the oceans, and in some ways overloading the land. And we're having to deal with that. So this third fire is really a human contrivance. It would disappear if we didn't continue to sustain it. Second fire would become first fire. It would continue in different forms, but third fire would disappear. So it's up to us to create these boundaries and to manage it and to show that we can use, we've shown we can use fire to disrupt. Now we have to show we can manage it. So we're in climate management. Now, whether we want to think of it in those terms or not, we've certainly demonstrated we can unmoor it from its historic patterns, but we haven't demonstrated that we can actually manage it in a way that doesn't do excessive harm.
You say we're in climate management. I think many of us would nod our heads with that. Some, though, has become politicized. You know, some would say, no, we're not in climate management.
Well, I think to those I would respond that you're demonstrating we're not managing it. We need to manage it. We're disrupting. We're not managing. And I don't know that we can argue about that seriously. We can certainly argue over what it means and what we should do about it. but I don't know that we can argue really about the fact that change really well outside the bounds of human existence is happening, and in ways that are not altogether favorable. We're not enhancing our habitat or that of others. We're really delaminating it, deranging it, and in ways that we don't really control, or we threaten. Nobody knows right now. We can adapt and mitigate. We can do lots of things to sort of muddle through. At some point, and I don't think anybody really knows where that point is or points, you begin changing qualitatively the whole state. So it's not like a balloon that you squeeze and it goes someplace else. You can squeeze it back. It breaks, and you're in a different world. I don't know where that is, but if we continue, we will begin crossing those thresholds.
Let's take a brief break. We'll come back much more with Stephen Pine, who's a fire historian, emeritus professor at Arizona State University. And his recent article in Scientific American is titled, "We Are Living in the Pyrocene at Our Peril." And we'll have more following this brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Stephen Pine, fire historian, emeritus professor at Arizona State University. And he's author of more than 30 books. Two most recent books are Five Suns, A Fire History of Mexico and Pyrocene Park. You can find him at stephenpine.com. And his recent article in Scientific American, that's what we're talking about today, is titled, "We Are Living in the Pyrocene at Our Peril." I was very interested, Stephen Pine, by your the passages in the article about our collective attitude toward second fire versus third fire, right? Second fire being fire on the landscape, third fire being the what a lot of people have felt, probably still feel, is the more civilized fire. We've contained fire. We've used it for our own purposes. I was interested to read Bernard Furneaux, who was head of Division of Forestry, predecessor Forest Service. He said, I guess, this uncontrolled fire on the landscape is a spectacle of bad habits and loose morals. And that was the attitude, I suppose.
Well, that was the attitude of professional foresters. Furneaux was our first professional forester in this country. He married an American woman and emigrated here. He had grown up in Prussia, and so he had very much the Prussian Germanic attitude towards forestry and fire. And Central Europe, the temperate climate zone of Europe, is distinguished by not having regular wet dry cycles. And so it has really no natural basis for fire. And so in that part of the world, all fires are the result of people creating them, creating the conditions for them, and so forth, primarily in agriculture. And so, in that sense, he was right that the fire scene is an expression of society and its values and habits. And he thought the American scene was completely out of control. The European scene is well contained by cultivation, and the U.S. was not. We had fires all over the place and very large fires. But that was the attitude of foresters. And foresters saw fire as an implacable enemy, something used at the hands of farmers and pastoralists to replace forests with pasture and fields, and generally using fire. Unfortunately, forestry became politically powerful as part of a conservation program in the 19th century. This was a global project. It was, in many ways, what sustainability is today. And a part of that project in the European colonial settings was creating a forest reserve, excluding people so that they couldn't use fire abusively, and then eliminating fire on this Central European model. And that turned out to be a very profound misreading of fire on the planet. and the role of foresters in conservation in it. So fire control became a foundational project, and in many ways an index. Are you succeeding in protecting these areas? And they used fire as that index. So we sort of got off, had a misstep right at the beginning. Foresters in many ways were not the best ones to deal with fires. People in wildlife, people using fire for pastoralism, even agriculture, had a much closer and sensible view of humans and fire. Anyway, we were stuck with it. So, forestry has since reformed, but those old attitudes got embedded very deeply around the world. And essentially German or Franco-German forestry established itself as the norm. This is what landscapes are supposed to look like, and we will try to make the world fit our norm. And it turns out that they were the anomaly. There were very small fractions of the world are sort of intrinsically fire-free because they don't have this climatic two-cycle engine going on. But the vast majority of the world does and has extensive fires. And so it was all misread right from the beginning. Nonetheless, the last 50 years, the agents, federal agencies have been working very, very strenuously to try to get fire back in.
I'll talk about a couple of images, powerful images from your article. One that I haven't seen these images, but you brought these into my mind. You say the earth is dividing into two realms of combustion, you know, some parts of the world, second fire, some a third fire. One great example, you say, is take a look at satellite images of the two Koreas at night.
Yeah, well, you can see this you can see part of it very simply. International Space Station has lots of images, plenty of images. And you look at that part of the world, and South Korea is ablaze in lights. These are evening photos. China and Russia on the other side of North Korea, lots of illumination. And then North Korea is essentially a dark zone. The capital has some, very little otherwise. But then if you flip to a daytime hotspot images, say by the MODIS satellite, which is how we record a lot, you will see lots and lots at the right time of the year, particularly in the spring, you'll see lots and lots of fires burning, almost completely contained by the political entity that is North Korea. And this is an interesting case of a peninsula, common heritage, common history, people, et cetera, divided by the war. And one makes this transition to a kind of third fire civilization, and one doesn't. And there it is, illuminated. You have one or the other. And you can see lots of these Earth at night satellite images. Usually they focus on cities, electric lights. But if you get, you can also get the living landscape lights. Africa and Europe makes a great contrast. That's what I used in the talk and have used elsewhere. And it's quite striking. Sub-Saharan Africa, so much of it is all in living landscapes, with a few patches for large cities where you see it's converted. And then Europe, almost all of it electrified. Now, not all of that is the result of combustion. I mean, France has a big nuclear program, hydropower. There are other sources of electricity, and now new stuff is coming into play. But it's essentially a third fire civilization. It was created under those conditions. And in the European model outside the Mediterranean's its own fire zone, but outside of that, the European sense that, as Furneaux put it, that wildfires were the result of bad behavior has proved true. Where are most of the fires today? In Europe, they're in Ukraine. They're in the battle zones. And you can see, I just saw an image recently on from northern Israel, Lebanon border, and you can see essentially this is where the fires are. So fires accompany wherever social breakdown occurs in cultivated landscapes, then that's where wildfires break out. So that it was not irrational. it was just applied inappropriately to other settings where it didn't make sense. So like most of us, they took their own, the world they grew up as normative. This is how it's supposed to be. And they would try to apply that. Of course, this is universal. And they thought that they were speaking with the transcendent conclusions and principles of modern science. Well, there was no fire science then. I mean, there really, nobody studied it at that point. It had disappeared. It had gone into mechanical engineering and combustion chemistry and so forth. But fire in the landscape, nobody was studying that. So they really weren't, they really didn't have science behind them. What they had were their collective opinions and shared values and perceptions of a group of this guild of foresters who saw fire as an enemy and something that needed to be contained. So we got started on the wrong foot. Since then, we're creating a fire science. We also lost all that traditional knowledge was part of it. And a lot now there's a lot of interest in recovering cultural burning by tribal groups. Indigenous peoples who also see it as part of a protest, a decolonizing project. But we shouldn't restrict it just to indigenous peoples because Europeans had plenty of fire in their history. It's all over the place. But it was embedded in agriculture. And when fire science started being funded, it was for these protected reserves and parks. So it was nominally wildlands. So it excluded agricultural burning. That didn't seem, we want to know how nature works. And in fact, agriculture is applied fire ecology in many cases. So they really misread that. We're still dealing with the consequences of how our fire science got. But my point being that there was a lot of traditional knowledge. And the quarrel was really not so much, was really a quarrel between elites and people who were actually living on the ground who needed it. And both sides got aspects of it right and got aspects wrong. But it was impossible almost to talk between them. It was just fire. We can't discriminate. We can't have nuanced discussions about fire. We just have to exclude it. People won't understand. How are they going to distinguish between good and bad fire? Who makes that decision? Let's just ban it. And we have the power to enforce that ban, and then maybe later at some other time we can work it out if we want to. And that sort of categorical decision turned out to be very damaging. There should have been a discussion, a sort of ongoing conversation about how we manage fires. And it really began, again, going back to 1910, these large fires that traumatized the Forest Service and sent us on our path. That same month in Northern California, there was a discussion called the light burning controversy, which argued that we should really not be trying to fight all these fires. We should be emulating the American Indian and routinely burning the understory of these forests, particularly in these montane pineries and the rest, and that would protect against large fires. And that discussion was there. It was, and it was split right from the beginning. We're talking about it. How do we interpret that? So I think now almost all observers wish we had taken the other side on that controversy. Which in effect we have, but had we done it earlier, we would still have problems, but we would not have this same kind of deeply rooted problems that we've created for ourselves. You should just tell me time out.
No, it's not.
I just keep going on and on.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. I appreciate it very much. We have reached the end of our time here. Stephen Pine's recent article in Scientific American is titled "We're Living in the Pyrocene at Our Peril." You can find him at stephenpine.com. And his two most recent books are Five Sons, A Fire History of Mexico, and Pyrocene Park. You find many other books of his as well. Stephen Pine, it's been such a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And enjoy the rest of your day.
Okay, you too.
It's One Sky, Many Cultures. Skywatcher Leo T here. As we gaze up into the beautiful cerulean blue skies and mild temps of this October so far, the Skywatcher happened to be up at 4 a.m. on Tuesday and went outside in the cool air and looked up high in the east. And as it has for a few months now, an ever-changing show up here. Pollux and Castor are up high, a curve that is continued now by Mars below this and forming more of a semicircle is Procyon. In the center of this was the nearly last quarter moon, and below this, spectacular Sirius leading you to Orion, and above to the right of all this is twinkling Taurus the Bull with its colorful star patterns. See the sky chart from Sky and Telescope on the Skywatcher Facebook page, or just get up at 4 a.m. And looking way out in space on our voyage, this from CNN Science. Astronomers have observed a massive pair of jets releasing from a supermassive black hole. Lots of supermassiveness going on here. The black hole is 7.5 billion light years from Earth. That's a little ways. Good thing. The megastructure spans 23 million light years in length, making these black hole jets the largest ever seen. As you know, black holes gobble up nearly everything that comes close to them, but a fraction of the material is ejected before an object falls in, forming a jet on either side of the black hole. This according to Martin Oy, a postdoctoral scholar at the California Institute of Technology and lead author on this new study. The findings were also published September 18th in the journal Nature. You can see an amazing animation which showcases these recently discovered black hole jets from the Science Communication Lab. The link on the Skywatcher Facebook page, it's entrancing. Black hole jets can accelerate radiation and particles close to the speed of light, causing them to glow in wavelengths visible to radio telescopes. Such a glow drew the attention of astronomers behind this new study while they were surveying the sky using Europe's Low Frequency Array Radio Telescope in 2018. The newly described jets have a power output equivalent of that of trillions of suns and are so massive that researchers have nicknamed the megastructure Porphyrion after a giant from Greek mythology. The cosmic web is a large-scale structure of the universe, a network of matter that pervades all space between galaxies. Also, a key to seeing black holes is the dust that surrounds them. And here on Earth is a story about kicking up the dust in the desert as One Sky, Many Cultures. Joel Long.
The horses arrive in clouds beneath the road, hooves drumming Earth, syncopated patterns too complex to transcribe. Every beat thrusts white dust into air around them. They run fast, 30, 35 miles per hour. They shake their heads. They breathe. They turn. They leap sage. They navigate between one another. They find the path that leads swiftly forward. Appaloosa, White, Pinto, Roan, Gray. Their manes fly behind them. Neglected sails left for wind to claim. By now, Sarah and I step from the car. The horses live with us, the bodies of a father and his adult daughter in the West Desert. Hundreds of horse bodies, the meat of them, the hunger, the thirst, gravity sending hundreds downhill toward us. We hear the sound inside us. The sound records in our bones and muscles, in the hurrying beat of our hearts. I turn to the hillside, and the horses are coming. Some still a half mile uphill, some 10 steps from our own mouths. Dust erupts from their hooves and blurs the horses behind. The ones close to us run in perfect detail, their shoulders, their torsos, the faint outline of ribs, their skin, the mouths, their tails spouting. Every detail from eye to brow clear, dark legs of the gray horse dipped in ink. Its mouth churns in furious motion, hind legs like the genius machine of creation. Some negligent god remembered the last minute to create something wonderful and change. The dust rendered ghosts of their fellow runners, some fading in middle dust, others nearly vanishing entirely, only to reappear as direction changes, as the dust falls and rises again with a step and kick. I'm sure that full horses disappear entirely. How can I possibly know?
Honored to speak with Joel Long, photographer, poet, teacher, and author of
Onaki Horses of the West Desert.
And he's also a drummer, by the way. I don't know what else you play. Do you play the trombone, too?
I do not play the trombone. I am only a drummer, which, you know, there are a bunch of jokes to be had there.
Well, yeah, and I've heard them. Maybe we can exchange fresh drummer jokes. We can make them up. But you have a new book coming out, and that is...
The other book called Watershed, which is really their personal narratives, but their personal narratives about the area, the Great Salt Lake, and the watershed around, mostly poems that deal with water, or essays that deal with water, but also personal history. And that's coming out in October next year, we hope. That's the goal.
Sounds good. Thanks for talking with us.
Glad to do so.
And keep looking up, look around, and get lost in space.
I'm always doing that.
I know you are.